You're just nervous about tomorrow. You'll get the promotion, we'll move into the new house, and we'll be happy, okay?
You should hear your voice. It just filled this room with excitement.
This is David and Linda Howard. They're happily married.
I want to have sex with you right here. Right now, right here.
And they're about to have a day.
This is it.
They'll remember the rest of their lives.
David, you're fired.
Fired? Oh, I'm fired!
Now, they're going to drop out.
We have to touch Indians. We have to see the mountains and the prairies and the whole rest of that song.
Set out to find the American dream.
Well, the movie you're basing your whole life on, Easy Rider, they had no nest egg.
They had a giant nest egg. They had all this cocaine.
And wind up lost in America.
To America, look out. Here we come.
Get your motor running.
Where are you going to go?
I don't know.
Head out on the highway.
Do you have a reservation?
Well, I just dropped out of society. I kind of live moment to moment. I really don't do reservation things anymore.
What do you think?
I think if Liv or not should get children, this would be their room.
Looking for adventure in whatever comes our way.
How much is left in the nest egg?
Nothing. Well, give or take 1,000.
Give or take 1,000. As the boldest experiment in advertising history, you give us our money back.
We're finished talking.
Don't get in that car! Stop it!
I've lost a woman. A whole woman.
Born to be wild.
That's not funny.
Born to be wild.
Any high-paying jobs in the immediate area?
You wouldn't be interested in it.
Well, you don't know me. I might love it. What is it?
Walk your bike! I'm warning you, walk your bike!
Dumb Frillo pad, fathead!
Fathead! Come on, bow!
Here we go!
Hey! Kill the child!
The Geffen Company presents Albert Brooks and Julie Haggerty, Lost in America.
Great movie. You gotta see it. It's historic.
Welcome to the Film and Water Podcast, proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and it's time once again to talk about an Albert Brooks movie. As everyone knows, Albert Brooks is like my favorite filmmaker. He's only made a handful of films, but I think virtually every one of them is a classic in its own way. So if we're talking about an Albert Brooks movie, I have to have my Brooks brother here with me, and that's Max Romero. Hi, Max.
Hey, Rob, how's it going?
I was so proud of that pun. I was just like, oh,
that's a good one.
Right there. No, thank you. We're here to talk about Lost in America, which is Albert Brooks' third film from 1985. It is the story of a high couple, David and Linda Howard, played by, of course, Albert Brooks and Julie Haggerty. They decide, the IMDb synopsis is, a husband and wife in their 30s decide to quit their jobs, live as free spirits, and cruise America in a Winnebago. That's not really what this movie's about. But before we get to all that, Max, I do want to ask you something. Now, I've heard a lot about you. I've heard a lot of good things. Are you familiar with the Fire and Water Podcast Network?
Well, I want to ask you something, Rob. Have you ever seen Easy Rider?
We are, of course, joking around here. This movie is, I think, eminently quotable. And as Max and I were just talking about off air, I think of all of Brooks's films, I would say Lost in America is his most accessible film. I saw this movie on cable when I was, would have been like 14, I guess, by the time it came to cable, or 15. And even though it's about middle-aged concerns, I just hooked into it immediately, and it really made me an Albert Brooks fan. But as we were saying off air, like the previous movie we talked about from Albert Brooks, Rubber and Romance, that is not the one to start with. I would argue that Lost in America is probably the most accessible one, and you would agree with that?
I would think so. I would say that, or not the Muse.
Defending Your Life
or Lost in America, I think, is where I would start people. Definitely not Modern Romance. As we were talking about before, that's really something that you need to ease into.
Yeah, you really do. David Howard, the film opens up with David and Linda in bed. And there's this whole great monologue from Rex Reed. We're talking about movies, which is like a bizarre thing. Which I don't even know.
Talking to Larry King.
Talking to Larry King about movies, yeah. But we find out that David Howard is one morning away from getting the promotion of his dreams. He works in advertising. He's about to become vice president of this company that he works for. And he is utterly convinced, or is he, that life is going to become better once he gets this promotion. And just the opening scene of him and his wife in bed is almost like a tour of the Albert Brooks neuroses, you know, character. Because he talks about how his wife sort of complains that maybe we're a little too controlled. And he's like, too controlled? Too controlled? And he talks about the house they're going to get. And he says, you know, once I am promoted into a role of responsibility, I'll be able to goof around. I won't need to be responsible because I'll be in a position of responsibility. Doesn't that make sense? And poor Julie Haggerty has to make sense of these complete, utter, nonsensical ramblings.
She tells him, oh, because we're too responsible. And he acts like it's the worst insult that she could have come up with.
He just takes it to heart so bad.
He totally freaks out about that because he says, what, I'm stuffy? I'm not spontaneous, and he just goes on for about 5 minutes about how terrible it is to be called responsible.
Yeah, he can't live with the idea that his, and again, it's you see it from Julie Haggerty's point of view, or Linda, I should say Linda's Howard point of view, because he talks about the reason he's worried is because they hired a moving company to pack their boxes, and he thinks maybe that's being a little too irresponsible, and that's what sets it off.
But every single thing that he talks about, he ends up contradicting himself.
Yes.
And like you said, it is a perfect encapsulation of Albert Brooks's neuroses. And it's really kind of a good encapsulation of this movie, just in the way that he deals with things or doesn't deal with things. And things go off the rails like really quick.
Yes. But the next morning he goes to work and he talks to the one secretary and she's like, you look great. You're going to get it. And he goes, I'm very nervous. Like he cannot be positive at all. Now there is one little moment and this may not mean anything, but I've seen this movie hundreds of times. First of all, this movie is only 90 minutes, which is one of the things I love about Albert Brooks movies. They get in and they get out. He does not waste your time with like a 2.5 hour running time. But there's this moment where he walks through the lobby of his own office, right? And there's a woman sitting there, and she says, hi, are you Bob? And he goes, no. And she's like, oh, I'm sorry. And it's not a joke line. It's not meant to be funny. And I've been trying to figure out what that moment means. And it, I don't know, maybe it didn't register with you at all, Max, but like that scene always jumps out at me because it seems so insignificant. But I think it's almost like that David is sort of like a blank at the office. Like right. That seems to suggest for a guy who is fairly important at this company, there's a woman there who doesn't even know who he is. I know that maybe I'm overthinking it, but that I always wondered why they put that in the movie.
Well, I thought what's interesting about that little scene, and like you said, it goes by really quickly, is that he is, you know, because this was released in 1985, and so of course it's the whole middle of the Reagan era, and. Right. You know, greed is good and all that sort of thing. And he wants to be successful and he wants things to go well and he wants to make money, but that's because he thinks that's going to change his life
right.
for the better. But he does not seem to have like that killer instinct of that mid-80s go, go, go kind of guy. And one of the things that I thought is interesting about that scene is that not only does he stop to talk, I mean, he doesn't stop, you know, to stop and have a whole conversation with her, but he acknowledges her and he shakes her hand.
Oh, that's right. He does, doesn't he?
Yeah. As he's walking by, he shakes her hand while he's saying, no, I'm not, but he, you know, but he's very polite about it, which I thought was very, a very interesting character moment.
Huh. I never thought about that, but yeah, I think you're probably right. Yeah. I mean, as we learn very shortly, I mean, first of all, he has the scene in the office while he's waiting to find out about his promotion. He gets on the phone with his Mercedes dealer. And all Albert Brooks movies have great audio scenes of somebody talking on a phone or a disembodied voice. In the movie Real Life, there's a whole scene with a movie producer who is never seen and just heard. And then there's a great phone call scene, of course, in Modern Romance. And there's a lot of that in Albert Brooks' comedy records where it's him talking to somebody some disembodied voice. He just loves that. And we see that he can't even really be that harsh with the Mercedes dealer. The Mercedes dealer is like pushing him into making a decision.
And and insulting him the whole way.
Insulting him the whole time. You know, he's like, you don't want the car. I got stars coming in. You know, he's like,
And he tells me, because he said, well, you know, so a car that costs, because I think it's, what, $44,000, something like that?
He's like, wow, that's still a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, today it's a lot of money.
And
he says, you know, you think there would be some leather in there? He goes, you want leather? I'll throw some shoes in there. Do you want the car or not?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, my God, he just keeps telling him things like that. But just one more thing about the Bob thing. Something else that occurred to me, too, is I wonder if it's an in-joke referring to his brother.
Oh, interesting. Bob Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Super, aka Super Dave Osborne. That's Super interesting. Diva. Oh, I don't even. Yeah, it's. Well, if I ever meet Albert Brooks, I'll have to ask him. odds are, he's on Twitter. That's really interesting. Yeah. Anyway, David gets his meeting, and he finds out in the most offhanded way possible that he is in fact not getting his promotion. He is getting moved to New York to work on a Ford. They've got Ford. They finally landed Ford. And if you've ever watched Mad Men, you know that when an advertising agency lands a car, that's like your big deal. You know, is that you landed a car. That's the whole big thing. And so, but David, the way the boss blows right by it, where he says, no, you're not going to be vice president. Phil Schiavone is going to be vice president. Oh, no. You can't do this to me. Phil. No, I'm vice president. No, Phil Schiavone's vice president. He just can't understand. And then I love the boss makes this incredible, wonderful excuse where he says, I can't afford to lose you as an executive. I need you creatively. Phil is more an executive type. And David says, oh, I see. So for Phil being here less than 2 years and being less creative, he gets this job I've wanted my whole life. And it's such a lame excuse. And I've heard kind of excuses like that in my life where someone less qualified than you is getting something you want and they sort of have to round about, well, he's less creative than you. It's like, that doesn't put food on my table, the fact that this guy is getting the job I want.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And he just goes off on Phil Schiavone, and which is comes back later when he's talking to his wife Linda. Goes, but you like Phil.
I have to see that stupid boat in that catalog again. He'll, you know, I hope the boat crashes and he lands and seals will eat him. And she's like, you like Phil. All right, fine. I don't wish him any harm, but I hope he finds his way into an island and I hope he crashes an island and never makes his way back to the mainland. Yeah, and so things get so heated that David gets fired. He tells his boss, basically, fuck you. He says, and he says, you don't want to risk 7 years in this company. And he just says, his response is, fuck you. You just can't have it anymore. And it's an amazing scene because I think we've all maybe not literally been there, but been there in that situation of you're just so frustrated when you've been met with something so completely unfair. And he does this whole thing where he talks about that other people of his generation went out to find themselves, and he took the corporate route. You know, he's sort of admitting, I sold out. This was supposed to be my payoff.
Yeah.
And I'm not getting...
He literally says, what did this get me?
Yeah.
What? You owe me 8 years. Give me my 8 years. I'm going to stay here until you give me back my 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I love, and another thing that I find so interesting about the Albert Brooks persona is that, as you talk about, it's very nebbish, but it's also, he's also does have some level of aggression, because the guy that's also in the meeting, who is from Brad, this is great, who is there to partner with him on the Ford account, where he's like, he's trying to pitch David on pitch lines for the account, da 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 da. This little town car. will take you away. And he's like, Brad, I don't want to hear this. And then he finally says, Brad, will you shut up? Your suit stinks, and I could hurt you.
You bald-headed fart! Shut up!
Calls him a bald-headed fart. You don't even know me, you bald-headed fart. I love that mix of that. He will get so mad, like. You can't picture Woody Allen doing that. You know,
no.
Woody Allen never does that to people. He just sort of takes the abuse. But Albert Brooks' guy is willing to kind of get into it with somebody, but it's just, I don't know, he kind of toggles back and forth between being put upon and then, you know. So anyway, he loses his job, and he goes back to his wife's office and tells her that he quit his job. And of course, Linda is sort of horrified. What do you mean you quit your job? He's like, you're right, we were too responsible. He's like, it was just a word. I didn't mean to say it. I didn't think you're going to quit your job over it.
And she's like a manager of some sort in a department store.
Right. And then he says he wants her to quit her job. And she, of course, in the most pedantic, says, well, I can't. There's nobody here for me to quit to.
Yeah, and at the same time, he's trying to talk her into having, because he's so hyped up. He also wants to have sex with her on her desk.
Yeah. Little quickie, come on right now, come on! Yeah, he's so, I'm on this high, but it's real! And he's so excited.
In front of this huge window that people keep walking by in front of also.
I love finally when he says, okay, we'll meet later on. He says, we'll have sex later. We'll go, and then I love when he walks by the window, you see him jump in the air, and he's like,
Well, and before that, too, he goes, a quickie, come on, quickie, no, okay, he just runs out.
Oh, poor Linda's just absolutely terrified. So they have a meeting later on at the house, and they come up with this plan where because of the house that they own, and they have a bunch of other money saved up, and he mentioned something about we took a ride on the inflation train, that the house that they bought is now worth hundreds of thousands of dollars, and they're not going to put it back into, as he puts it, a behemoth. They're going to just quit their jobs and buy a Winnebago and just travel the country, as he puts it, being and doing and writing and having sex in front of Indians, as he puts it at one point. And that's their plan. And, you know, even when I was a kid, I figured – I can't say I remember what happened, what my thoughts were watching this movie for the first time. But I knew that this wasn't going to work. Because, I mean, you're cutting yourself off from all your friends. Like, it's one thing to downsize your home, you know, where you're like, oh, maybe we could go move to, you know, Vermont and buy a tiny little cabin instead of this raging behemoth that we own in California. But it's another thing entirely to just travel the country for the rest of your life. Like, that right. seems nuts. That doesn't seem appealing to me.
Well, and that seems really interesting to me in terms of the historical context, because, like, again, this is set in the mid-80s. And so these people probably would have been, you know, teenagers, young people during the whole, you know, 60s sexual revolution
right.
time. And you know, as you said, he says, I chose to go – basically, I chose to sell out
yeah.
instead of dropping out. Which they refer to a lot. You know, they keep saying we're dropping out of society.
Yeah.
and it's interesting because I saw an interview with Albert Brooks when he's talking about this, and he's, you know, because Easy Rider is mentioned over and over again in this movie, and he talks about how Easy Rider was the inspiration for this, but he was saying this would be what would happen if you took Easy Rider but made it real.
Right.
You know, if this is what would probably actually happen to most people trying to drop out of society.
Yeah.
And yeah, and like you mentioned, he's, you know, they're moving, but they're not moving into a smaller place. They're moving into a bigger place, and they're trying to, because they're expecting this huge promotion, and they're going to make more money, and, you know, so they're, in his mind, that he's trying to reject this whole lifestyle that he's had and that he's been pursuing all this time.
Right. Yeah. You kind of know that it's not going to take, because he didn't quit his job over a moral,
right.
You know, awakening. It's because he didn't get the promotion.
Because he's mad. Yeah.
Because he's mad. I mean, that's one of the things I find so interesting about Albert Brooks movies, is that he is simultaneously sympathetic to his characters, but also pitiless. If that's even possible, I guess. I think it goes back and forth. Like, he is. We get a very – him and his screenwriter, Monica Johnson, who he co-wrote pretty much all his movies with, who I'm completely unfamiliar with. Monica, like, I've never seen an interview with her. I don't know who she is other than his collaborator. But, boy, she deserves to be more famous, because I think these movies that she did with him are just perfect. But, you know, he really presents David Howard as a guy – you just know this is going to go wrong. You just know it. And it reminds me in a weird way of The Shining, where it's like when you see Jack Nicholson and Shelley Duvall driving to the hotel, you just know things are going to go horribly wrong. And I've seen some people criticize The Shining and saying it's too predictable, because clearly Jack Nicholson's going to go insane because it's Jack Nicholson. But to me, that's the thing that's compelling, is that it's like watching a train – it's watching a car accident in slow motion. You know this is going to go wrong, and you can't pull away. And that's what's happening here, because they have such rosy views of what life is going to be like. And you're like, they wanted to have a tennis court a day ago.
Yeah.
And now they're going to drop out and write books? Like, how mm-hmm. is that going to work? So then they make their way across the country, and he decides to stop in Las Vegas first to get remarried in a romantic gesture. And here is the first indication that they are not on the same page, because he wants to camp out under the stars. And what does Linda want? She wants to get a big hotel, the nicest right. room, watch porno movies, celebrate their heads off, as she puts it. And she refers to it as an old-fashioned vacation. And right. you're like, well, no, this is the absolute last thing you should be doing if you're looking to conserve, live off the $800,000 that you've saved up. But he right. goes along
the
with
nest
it.
Egg. The nest egg, as they call it.
The nest egg. The nest egg concept, as we will now call it. yeah, I mean, and so it's like in that moment, you just know this is not going to go right. And then, of course, we find that I love that whole scene where he tries to book the room with no reservation. And his constant refrain is, well, I've just dropped out of society. I really don't do reservations. And the guy's like,
And he keeps telling people that throughout the movie.
Yeah.
Well, dropped out of society.
As is that some sort of like mantra that'll just like it's a key that'll open any door for you. Well, I just dropped out of society,
and as if people will know what the hell that even means.
Yeah, the hotel clerk is like, well, he's like, well, I don't really do reservations, and the hotel clerk's like, well, we do. So, and then he has to bribe the guy to get the finest suite, and of course, the suite they get is a shithole.
The junior honeymoon suite,
junior bridal suite, and he's like, junior bridal suite. I paid for the senior, and of course, the clerk is. I don't know, the completely most unhelpful clerk. And he's like, there's two beds here. Can we push these together? I don't know. Is there a tub? I don't just see a shower. I don't know. And then he tips the guy anyway, too.
And I love that. That's a great bit of visual humor is that, you know, because you're expecting this big, you know, tacky Vegas heart-shaped bed. And it's these two little heart-shaped beds yeah. side by side. And then she goes, you know, because part of the plan was, oh, we're going to take a bath together. And, oh, we haven't taken a bath together in so long. And he goes, oh, there's no bathtub. Just a tiny heart-shaped shower.
Yeah. Which I don't even understand on the physical level. Like, what's a heart-shaped shower? What does that even look like? I don't even understand. So, yeah, as he puts it, we're reduced to a hot shower and porno movies. That's it. And so then we have a hard cut where David wakes up in the middle of the night or very early in the morning. Linda's gone. He wanders downstairs and finds her gambling. And she seems to be in a bit of a mania because she's talking about 22, 22, 2, 22. Put it on. And
come back to me, 22.
Come back to me, 22. Come back. And, yeah, she's Julie Haggerty, man. One of the great underrated actresses from the 80s. She's just so funny in this part. And
she really nails it. Oh, she just really brings it across in this movie.
And so it's in that scene where we get our first inkling of Gary Marshall as the casino owner. And he talks about, I think you need to talk to your wife. And he's like, well, how bad is it? And he's like, talk. And he's like, talk. And he finally speaks. So she loses on 22. Oh, no, they win. She wins on 22, and she wins $35. Right. And he's right. like, yay, we're up. We're up, right? And she goes, no, we're down. Still down. How down? Still down. Down. Real down.
So come on, 22. She keeps betting 22. She just keeps 22. Betting over and over.
And you even have that one guy who's at the table, and he's like, she really likes that.
She really likes 22.
Really like 22. So they go to the casino. I'm sorry. They go to the cafe. And he's in his robe, which is fantastic. I love that whole bit about, you can't come in here dressed like that. He's like, I saw Electric Horseman. Robert Redford came in here with a horse. So they have this conversation, and this is where the bomb drops, where we find out that at one point Linda was up $100,000.
Right.
And he's like, where do you get off gambling that kind of money? And she's like, I never felt such power. And he's like, well, and she's like, well, I did lose a bit. Well, how much did you lost the money you had? Yes. Did you lose the I forget some other form of the money? Yes, I lost it. He goes, you didn't touch the traveler's checks.
The traveler's checks.
Yeah. No. Yes. The core of the nest egg. And he's like, how much is left? Nothing. give or take $1,000.
Right. All this money, all this planning that went into it, just in a night, over.
Gone. Brooks, man, the scene of him, there's no music to that scene. It's just him reacting, and he has almost like a heart attack right there at the table. And he just can't believe it. He's like, no. And he's like, there's one point where he's literally has no words, or he's just like, he cannot deal with it. It's it's like a modern nightmare. And I think he even says it's like a Twilight Zone. I think he refers to it.
Yes. At point. Yeah. Yeah, he does. And it's, and what's funny, part of what's funny about that scene is that Julie Haggerty, you know, Linda, is still on this gambler's high. And she really doesn't quite understand why he's so bad.
Yeah.
She's just like, but it's fine. It's fine. We're going to be okay. We're okay. And it's like, we're not okay. We have nothing left. And they have, all they have now is whatever money they have left, which turns out to be like, what, $854?
I think $802, I think, is the $802. Funny number, the $2.
And this huge Winnebago that they bought.
Yeah.
And that's all they have left.
Yeah. And it leads to, that scene leads to, in a movie full of great set pieces. I mean, that's the thing. Albert Brooks was a stand-up comedian before he ever made a film. And so I think his films are constructed the way you would construct a comedy bit, where there's like, there's acts, there's specific, this opening scene, and then there's this other scene, and things are very concentrated. And they all, I mean, in his best films, I think they all add up to be, you know, more than the sum of their parts, but they really are very distinctive. And the scene that follows is the scene pretty much people who've never even seen this movie have seen or am aware of. And it's where he goes to talk to Gary Marshall as the head of the casino with the goal of getting his money back. And of course, Gary Marshall, as the head of the casino, is not going to give his money back. But what he does is he tries to pitch himself as this advertising expert and coming up with this plan of where the Desert Inn, you know, David and Linda Howard made a mistake and the Desert Inn fixed it. They just gave them their money back. They fixed it. And he, as he keeps trying to pitch, he's like, you don't think of anything when you come to Las Vegas. And Gary Marshall's like, gambling. You think of gambling. That's why they call it Las Vegas. Gambling, Las Vegas, gambling. That's what you call it.
And Gary Marshall is so patient with him.
Oh, my God.
And then that just amps up because Albert Brooks gets more and more animated as it goes on. And Gary Marshall is just flat calm.
Yeah.
And you know, and a lifetime of watching movies, you kind of expect a casino owner to have Goombas and, you know, to have him to threaten him and all this. No, Gary Marshall just says, no, we're not going to do that. Yeah.
I love the deal. He says, I know you lost a lot of money here. Your food and your room comped. That's going to somehow fix it. And yeah, you're right. Brooks gets increasingly more desperate until eventually he starts settling on a campaign where he talks about Christmas. I know, that's it. That's it. The Desert Inn has heart. The Desert Inn has heart. That's my jingle. Enough with the jingle. Thank you. Anyway. And he finally sort of, and he says, he settles on Miracle on 34th Street. And again, that's another thing I love about Albert Brooks movies is that his characters have seen movies.
Yeah.
You know, in other movies, characters don't go to movies. They don't, like, engage in entertainment. They just sort of live in this sort of parallel universe. But in these movies, all of Albert Brooks' characters are familiar with television and movies and stuff. And so he pitches him, the casino owner, on Miracle on 34th Street, where, you know, Santa's going to fix everything. And I love that Gary Marshall refers to him as Santa Claus. I love that he doesn't Santa say Claus, Santa, yeah. Santa Claus. And he says, in that movie, Santa Claus fixed everything. And he said, well, that's the campaign. What's the campaign? The Desert Inn, Las Vegas, a Christmas place to be. And, of course, that earns the response, we're done talking.
We're done talking.
Now, I have seen this movie so many times that I have had the opportunity to do thought experiments where I have said, what would I do in this situation? Mm. As I'm heading up the stairs in my flip-flops and my bathrobe,
your bathrobe,
what would I do to sell this idea? And I would not have tried to bullshit Gary Marshall's character. I would have been honest and simply said, look, my wife effed up royally. I had no idea she had a gambling problem. As she mentioned, she's only gambled twice. This is the second time. I would be straight up honest with him and say, I'm begging you for our money back, and I promise you we will never come back to this town. We will never say one word. I would throw myself on the mercy of the guy. I would not try and sell him on a campaign. I would just be as honest as possible. I mean, what else have you got to lose?
Right. Yeah, no, and I think that says something about the character of David, because he goes in there, and he at some point, when he first starts talking to him, he tells him, look, I'm in advertising. This is what I do for
Boston
a living.
Boston McMahon. You've heard of them?
Boston McMahon. Exactly. Worldwide. Worldwide. And, you know, this is what I do for a living, but I'm going to give this to you for free.
Yeah. You know, like, don't keep this secret, because if other people hear this, they're going to want it.
Right. You know, that this, you know, this idea that he, you know, he's so neurotic, but at the same time, he has such confidence in himself as an idea guy that he thinks he can not only sell this crazy idea to Gary Marshall, but first that he's going to be even sell him on the idea that his ideas have any kind of value when he lost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah. I love
I would not. I would not try to bullshit my way through that either.
No, I would have just. I would have been totally honest with the guy and just say, "Look, I never knew my wife had this gambling problem. This is just, you know, please, please, or like, give me half the money back. You know what I mean? Like something. Just, you know, we will leave and you'll never hear from us again." And you're right. I love the repeating bit, and this is something that I almost think that Brooks gets at. We, you know, in current political parlance, we hear about the bubble, you know, people living in the bubble, where it's a liberal bubble or a conservative bubble or a Fox News bubble or whatever. We hear a lot about that. But this is on Brooks's mind, you know, way back in 1985, because he keeps talking to people about Ross and McMahon as if that name means anything, and not a single person has heard of this company.
No, you know? Not one person knows what he's talking about.
He keeps thinking that's impressive. And I love the idea that in his mind, that's a huge thing. But to the average person, they're like, I don't know what that is. Like, it means nothing to me. And I love that. I love that as a repeating joke. So, of course, he doesn't get the money back. And that leaves David and Howard to drive the country in their Winnebago with $802 and no plan. Just no plan. And that's like sort of the second half of this movie of what are these people going to do. And you know, there are very few movies I think that deal with financial hardship in a kind of non-romantic way, if you know what I mean, because it's like, okay, you know, The Grapes of Wrath, you know, that's about poor people, but it's like the movie's kind of almost romantic. I don't want to say anything bad about The Grapes of Wrath, it's a masterpiece, but it's like those people are used to their hardship. These people, David and Linda Howard, are completely unaware and unfamiliar with how to survive with no money. And poor Albert Brooks just doesn't know what to do because what? They have this thing that's going to cost $1,000 to fill up with gas. There's one point where she says, let's live in Canada. And he's like, do you have any idea how much gas it takes to get to Canada? He's like
– And they're in Arizona at that point, I think. Yeah, no, and I think that's completely true, and I think it's interesting because, you know, there's, and I've said this in conversation with other people, you know, there's nothing honorable about being poor, you know, and people who don't have money, you know, they want to have money. Yep. We all want to have money. No one wants to struggle. There's no romance in the struggle.
Not at all.
And I think it's kind of interesting that they're exploring this a little bit, especially with people who obviously have not had to struggle, if not for years, if ever.
Yeah, yeah. It reminds me a lot of I saw an interview many, many years ago with Bill Murray where he was asked once. He said people had say to him, "I've always wanted to be rich and famous," and he said, "My advice is always go for rich and see if that doesn't solve 90% of your problems." Right. And I think about that. Sure. And so there's even this great moment where they get pulled over by a cop, a motorcycle cop, who gives them a ticket for speeding. And he says, how much is this ticket going to cost? And he's like, about $80, $90. And he said, well, we can't pay that.
$140.
We can't pay that. Oh, no, that's too much. We can't pay that. We can't do it. And the cop's like, this isn't no swap meet. Like, what are you talking about? And, of course, he gets out of it by mentioning – he says, have you ever seen – it's Linda says, have you ever seen The Easy Rider? Why did you ask me that? It's my favorite movie. He's, oh, my husband's based his whole life on it. And he's like, oh, really? And they bond over this and he gets out of the ticket. And that's when he says, well, now you're up $140.
You're up $140. Yeah. That's a very sweet scene. And actually, that's one of my favorite scenes because of what Albert Brooks says when she tells him, oh, my husband has based his whole life on that movie. And Albert Brooks kind of as an aside says, well, the last 2 weeks.
Yeah. The last 2 weeks, yes. My name's David. Yeah, yeah. I do love how much he considers himself a rebel, because we do see the scene early on where he's hitting the road set to
Born to be Wild,
and he sees that motorcyclist and he gives him the thumbs up, and the motorcyclist gives him the finger because it's like, we're not brothers. What are you talking about? He's just, yeah.
Yeah, he's driving this huge tank of a vehicle. I mean, this old style Winnebago. Yeah. And it's really funny how he sees himself as I think that's part of the crux of the humor in this, is that he really thinks that he has dropped out of society when he has not dropped out at all.
No, he just doesn't have a job.
He's very comfortable. Yeah. Yeah, he's very comfortable with this nest egg that they have. And yeah, and when they lose it, that's when things really start to go off the rails.
Right. When they end up visiting Hoover Dam and they have the whole argument about the nest egg, because he says, Linda says, you're basing this whole movie on a movie. You're basing your whole life on this movie. They didn't have a nest egg. And he's like, yes, they did. They had cocaine.
Cocaine.
No, they didn't. Yes, they did. And then he's like, I don't want to be out here in front of nature's great wonders arguing about an old movie. If you can figure out a way to make $800 last a lifetime, I'll be inside. And there's this whole great bit where she apologizes on and on and on about losing the nest egg. And he says, don't say that word. You're not allowed to use the word nest egg. That word is verboten. If you see birds in a tree, they live in a big stick, you know. And you have things over toast. You are not allowed to use nest or egg. Yeah, he's just absolutely. And of course, you know, the cracks form in their marriage, because how could it not? I mean, this is beyond stressful. And at one point, Linda ends up hitchhiking and gets picked up by a guy, and he loses her. He loses, as he puts it, I lost a whole woman.
Yeah. Yeah, and he jumps into the Winnebago and chases after her, but of course he falls behind because the guy's in a little roadster.
Right.
And he's driving this tank, and he does eventually catch up to them at a diner. He sees the car, and it's interesting, just really quickly, because at the beginning of the movie, Linda's talking to her assistant and about how things are hard and how she doesn't have any interest in anything anymore, and the assistant actually tells her, well, you could always just get divorced.
Right.
You know, and it's like this idea, I guess, of the 80s too, when, you know, divorce was this simple thing, this easy way to change your life. And in a way, you know, that's what everyone in this movie is trying to do. Well, Linda and David, you know, they're all trying to change, because Linda gets on board with the idea pretty quickly when he proposes it.
Mm-hmm.
And when she leaves, when she starts hitchhiking, she tells him, well, this makes it easier now. Now we can just get a divorce and you don't have to worry about this anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so she tells him, you know, we're going to get divorced. And he's completely flabbergasted by that.
Yes. Yeah. She kind of brings down the hammer. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned that scene with the coworker, who's played by Maggie Roswell from The Simpsons. She does like 1,000 voices, really? On The Simpsons. Yeah, it's Maggie Roswell. I'm assuming they all know each other because of, the kid Albert Brooks has been on The Simpsons and stuff like that,
right,
too. But we get indications that Linda is not satisfied with her life. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that this movie makes, like, the idea that she loses the money palatable is that, you know, that David is probably so self-centered with his own problems that he's kind of papering over her problems.
Right.
You know, there's a scene where they talk about going to the new house to talk about the kitchen renovation. And, you know, she doesn't want to do it alone, and he just blows her off.
Right.
And so you know that maybe for a couple of years – she's been suffering in silence, that she's not happy either. But David is just so wrapped up in his own worries and neuroses that he hasn't been paying attention to her. And so this is how it comes out. It comes out with, right, her gambling their nest egg away. I do want to mention the guy that picks her up, the convict, is played by Donald Gibb, who is, of course, most famous for playing Ogre
in
the Revenge of the Nerds movies. And I love that whole bit where he gets into a fight with Albert Brooks, where he punches him and he says, you know, I'm wanted, man, but if I ever run into you again, I'll be back, man. You're a dead man. And I love when he says,
well, he punches him once, and then Albert Brooks spends the rest of the so-called fight running away.
Yeah. I love their conversation afterwards where he's like, what did you two talk about? And she's like, oh, he lost his job. He was in prison. He's like, well,
out of the army.
Yeah. He was out of the army. And he's like, well, what was he on bail for? He's like, well, according to him, those guys were dead when he got there.
I love that line. That is, and the way she delivers it is just so innocent in a way.
She believes. But she totally believes in what he said.
But at the same time, you kind of get the sense that Linda knows. You know, she knows what's going on. She's just a lot more. She downplays it a lot more. And in a weird way, when you know this is David's dream. You know, this is his Easy Rider fantasy. But she's the one who kind of keeps it going. You know, there are times when David probably would have given up on the whole thing. But she's the one who's saying, no, let's go to Canada. Let's go here. Let's go there. And he's the one saying, we don't have enough gas. We can only go to New Mexico or Arizona. You know? And which is another thing I love about this movie. This is supposed to be, you know, this big road trip movie. And they basically make a day trip. They never get farther than Arizona.
I never thought of that, but you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, they only go from L.A. to Arizona.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah, you're right. She handles it, you know, she handles it really well. She kind of just is like, all right, well, we'll just go and drive to Canada and we'll figure something out. But, of course, they can't do that because they don't have any money. So they stop in Arizona. They stop at a park for mobile homes. Stafford, Arizona. And David out his window sees these two old guys talking. And they're clearly like lifers. And they've been living there, and that terrifies him. They don't necessarily suggest that, but I think it does because the next morning he's like, "We have got to go get jobs. We got to get good jobs. We need to get jobs, you know." And so they both go out and search for different jobs. And David runs into a guy. First of all, he asks for a job, a delivery man job, with his Winnebago. And the guy's like, "You couldn't pay for the gas of what I would pay you." And he's like, "What do you, you know, a mobile home? That's not going to work." And then he directs him to the employment office.
He says, maybe I should change the sign to delivery boy. That's really more what I'm looking for.
Yeah, leave the sign. Leave the sign alone. The sign is fine. And so he goes to the unemployment office and he meets with his very unhelpful unemployment clerk who just – I love there's that whole line where he says, well, what are you doing here in Stafford? He says, well, I'm here to change my life. And then he says – and then he gets into the salary. He says, what kind of money were you making before? Around $100,000. The base with Valerie, and then I was in a bonus situation depending on the year we have. And the guy's like, what kind of time frame are we talking about here? A year? Yeah. And he says, you couldn't change your life on $100,000 a year? Which
that line is brutal.
That's completely a reasonable question.
Oh, my God. And you can see that is the line that wakes David up.
Yeah.
That when he says that, you can kind of see that it shakes him a little bit. Because, I mean, really, $100,000 a year and you're complaining. that's a completely reasonable question. You couldn't change your life on $100,000 a year?
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. And so I love what he mocks him about. And he's, you know, he says, do you have any jobs in, like, the executive file? Maybe some sort of another.
The white-collar file?
The white-collar box? What kind of box would that be? Well, just a box of higher-paying jobs. And he's like, oh, I know. You mean the $100,000 box. This is such a dick.
I'm surprised that a town, because I mean, it's obviously a small town. He gets around by walking.
Yeah.
And he, you know, I'm surprised that there's even an employment office in that that town.
Yeah. Seriously. And it's funny because the guy, both the old guys that David runs into, the guy that runs the pharmacy, and then the guy who's the insurance is the unemployment guy. They've been in other Albert Brooks movies. In little parts, yeah. So it's like they're kind of these recurring bit players, which is sort of funny to me. I love that he kind of uses these stock guys. So anyway, David ends up getting a job as as a crossing guard.
$5.50 an hour.
$5.15 an hour plus benefits. One of the benefits.
That's right, plus benefits.
You get to drive to and from school if you need it. That's the benefits there. So, and of course, David and Linda don't have kids. And it's interesting that the children are never mentioned in this movie, like not even the possibility of them ever having kids, which is kind of unusual. And I think sort of refreshing in that this makes this movie. I mean, it probably wouldn't be funny at all if you had kids and you were subjecting them to this lifestyle. It would be probably tragic. So which is why they don't have kids. But he becomes a crossing guard, which is not an ideal job for him because he doesn't like children, clearly. Children don't like him either. They call him Big Brillo Fathead, you know. Kill the child! He's yelling at the car to come by and hit the kids. And then Linda talks about that she got a job, but she doesn't want to jinx it because she doesn't know what she's going to get as an assistant manager.
Ooh. An assistant manager, yeah.
Assistant manager, that sounds very important. And then we find out, of course, that Linda's job is the assistant manager at Der Wiener Schnitzel.
Yeah, because he comes home and he's wearing his crossing guard uniform.
Yeah.
And she's wearing her, you know,
hot dog
uniform. And they both kind of tell each other, what the hell are you wearing?
Yeah. I'm a crossing guard. What are you? Oh, I got it. I'm the assistant manager at Der Wiener Schnitzel. That was the job? That was the job you're waiting for? And then we meet Skip.
You're selling hot dogs?
You're selling hot dogs. We meet the manager, Skip, who is like a 16-year-old. Right. I love that. He's like, this is my boss.
Who for some reason is in their Winnebago using the bathroom.
Yeah. Yeah, I love his first comment is, hey, when you flush the toilet, where does it go? Right. But I love the whole bit about, this is your boss? He slept on it? And he, you know. And then, of course, Skip talks about the whole thing where he says, your wife told me what you guys did. And he's like, that sounds really cool. Maybe I'll do it when I get old. Yeah. Which is brutal. Oh, my God. And they do, there's a whole run.
Watching Flintstones on there.
Yeah, I was watching Flintstones on the TV. There's the whole run about that Linda discovered that they were eating frozen French fries. They weren't eating them. They weren't cooking them properly.
Right.
And this is the point where the movie has a abrupt turn. And the thing that I the thing I think about when I see how this movie ends is, are you familiar with the phrase in comedy, the phrase dropping the cow? Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Okay.
No.
This is apparently a thing that British comedians – it was a phrase that British comedians coined, and Monty Python would use it a lot. And it's called dropping the cow. And what it means is when you have a comedy sketch, once you have established the premise and you have kind of done the joke, just drop the sketch and move on. Don't worry about coming up with an ending. Just stop. Right. Just look, you know that the joke has been told. We're moving on. And Saturday Night Live, actually, in its early days, literally dropped a cow. They would drop a canvas cow from the rafters in the middle of a sketch. And they would say, we've dropped the cow, and it would move on. I think this movie does that. This movie establishes that there is no more comedy left to be mined in their ongoing agony. Because as David establishes, he's like, at the rate we're going, and at our ages, and the jobs that we have, we'll see another nest egg. Never. We'll never see another nest egg. And so he has this whole thing where he says, I think we've had a great time together, and I wouldn't trade it for the world. And the fact that we're still together means that we're not breaking up, and I feel great about that. She's, me too. Oh, great. He says, so I have kind of a contingency plan. And I don't want to ruin it. She says, I have a plan too. Oh, really? What's your plan? No, I'm going to hear your plan first. Yeah. Okay. Well, and she says, my plan is we drive to New York as soon as possible. Yeah. And he says, and I eat shit? And she says, yes, my plan too.
I love that scene because when he says, and eat shit? And I eat shit? And he has this big grin on his face. Because you can just see the relief coming off of him.
Yeah, they're both on the same page that eventually, okay. And then he heads back to the set of New York, New York, which is, of course, the song at the beginning of the movie. They make their way back to New York, and we end up seeing David and Linda. Clearly, he's gotten his job back, and he even runs into Brad. He runs into Brad on the street, which Brad is terrified of. I love what he sees. Brad, how you doing? And Brad just starts running away from him at a full gallop. And we
I don't even know if he's gotten his job back at that point. Because they park in front of the building, and he jumps out of the Winnebago, and Linda's like in a bathrobe, and her hair's all – and she basically says, good luck.
Assumed he had the job at that point, but maybe you're right. Maybe he's
– I don't know, because Brad seems surprised to see him.
Well, that's true. You're right. That is true. I do wonder how
he chases him into the building.
He does. I do wonder how the hell Linda drove around a Winnebago in New York City. I mean, I've driven in New York City, and that's tough. Let alone trying to find a place to park a Winnebago. But we find out via a crawl, which Albert Brooks used in all three of his movies up to this point, that David did get his job back at a 33% salary cut, but with better medical.
Yeah. And Linda gets a job at Bloomingdale's.
Oh, that's right. That's right. She gets a job at
Bloomingdale's. And has their first child.
Oh, that's right. They do. They mention that. Right. They're expecting their first child. And so Roger Ebert, who was a big fan of Albert Brooks, said his only criticism of this movie is that he feels like it ends too early and that it ends too abruptly. But I don't agree with that. I think this movie ends at exactly the moment it needs to end for all the reasons I talked about. I think it's it, watching them have these miserable jobs would have just been sort of – not that Albert Brooks couldn't have found a way to make it funny. But I really think like the premise has been established now. Their life is ruined. They face a bleak future. And they are going to just go right back to their, they, you know, the world, the society has thoroughly kicked them in the ass, and they are retreating with their tail between their legs. And that's the story. That's what this right. movie's about.
Yeah, the whole point is that most people, I think most people have had this kind of fantasy of, you know, oh, let's just chuck it all and run away, and we're going to live this bohemian lifestyle. But no one ever follows up with, and then what?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think that's what Albert Brooks does here, and that's what's funny about it, is that that does not last long.
Yeah.
You know, eventually you're going, no, I miss all the trappings of modern lifestyle that I had. And yeah, you know, I think, you know, I was talking about this with my wife earlier, Sandy, and we were both talking about how this movie almost feels like a play. You know, I could see this being done on stage very easily.
Interesting.
And it kind of has those beats and, yeah, I think if this had been extended in any kind of real way, it stops, like, you know, I had mentioned earlier that this is kind of a light movie. And I think if you kept going with it, it wouldn't be a light movie anymore. And the whole tone would have changed. Because, yeah, then you're just kind of wallowing in this misery. And it's not funny anymore.
Yes. Yeah, they basically put up with their shitty jobs for one day each. Before right. they quit. And of course, David, with I forgot to mention, David, while he's working as a crossing guard, he runs into a guy driving a Mercedes, driving the very car that he wanted. And he says, you like this car? Hey, what's not to like? You know? Right. And so he's reminded of all the things. It kind of reminds me of, like, the idea that you are going to live, you know, in this, like, $500,000 home. And then you're going to give it all up to write books as he puts it, visit the mountains and the prairies and the whole rest of that song.
Touch Indians. Yeah.
We need to touch Indians. but like, it's kind of like people who like eat lots of junk food and then they decide on New Year's Eve, I'm going to diet. And starting tomorrow, I'm going to eat nothing but spinach, kale, and fruit.
Right. You're
like, that's too extreme. You have to ease, as you put it, in terms of Albert Brooks movies, you have to ease into it. You can't go from eating donuts and cookies and cake to eating fruit and broccoli. You have
right.
to slowly, because you know that you're going to, if you overdo it, you're going to snap back extra hard. And that's exactly what happens to these two. It's like, again, they could have just quit. If he lost his job, they could have downgraded their house, bought a smaller house, and lived off the savings for a while, but
right.
instead they go way overboard, just way overboard, and you just know it's all going to fail. And it's very funny to me in that I kind of imagine the studios that make these movies have a tough time selling them because Albert Brooks's rhythm is just so different than what you're expecting. And if you watch the trailer, which you heard over the opening of this episode, it makes it like virtually the whole trailer takes place in Las Vegas. So it makes it sound like this movie's almost like Albert Brooks's Vegas vacation.
Right.
You know, where it's
right.
like, oh, wacky. It's like the, you know, the Hangover with Albert Brooks. And that's not what this movie is. The Vegas is a tiny, tiny part of this movie. But I imagine that when they were trying to sell it, they were like, we have to make it sound wacky. You know,
right.
like, oh, crazy, you know, all sorts of, you know, high roller Vegas stuff. And so that's why you think this movie is that what it is. But it's not. It's really amazingly downbeat as it goes through, but it always remains funny to me. It's funny till the very end. It's funny till the crawl, and and just the idea that, again, the movie ends when it needs to end. That's one of the things I love about Albert Brooks movies. They are all like 90-95 minutes. He knows exactly how short or how long his movies need to be, and I think that says a lot about him as a director and as writer and editor. I guess he didn't edit these movies, but he knows the story he needs to tell.
Right, it's really lean. I can't think of any part in this movie that I would take out.
No, no.
You know, I can't imagine taking, because it all moves the story forward. Because even Vegas, you know, like you're saying, Las Vegas is there to take their money away. you know, it's the thing that is there just to put them on the next level of, oh my God, what are we going to do? Because I really think that if they hadn't lost the money, just with these characters, unless you mentioned that they're real people, that they would have maybe vacationed for a couple of weeks and then gone back.
Right.
you know, or found other jobs or something like that. I don't think it ever was going to stick.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah, but, yeah, yeah.
But you know, losing their money and all that just kind of really accelerated everything. And that's kind of what this whole movie feels like. You know, it's you are on this because they're gone for like what, maybe 2-3 days?
Yeah, it doesn't last long. I mean, Vegas is literally their first stop. They talk about when they have the party and they say we're gonna stop in Vegas and get remarried. So yeah, this whole trip is like a week at most.
Yeah, 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 exactly. And you know, and Vegas is not far from LA.
Right,
you know,
right.
So it's like a few hours drive that took. And yeah, and just one thing after another happens, and next thing you know, they're on their way to New York.
Yeah. Oh God. He obviously deals. He mentions New York as saying, "You don't want to go back to New York because they steal everything you own the minute you land." You know, and of course, he has to deal with that when he gets back to New York. And so yeah, it's nice that the Howards get a happy if diminished ending, which is only appropriate. Like I said, I've seen it hundreds of times. I do think, as you say, Max, I think it is his most accessible, right up there with Defending Your Life. I put probably the two of them next to one another. But they really, you know, but at the same time, it features Albert Brooks's just completely clear-eyed view of a certain generation, his generation of people that, you know, consider themselves these sort of rebels, and yet they are just as attached to their material things as anybody else and stuff like that. And I think it's wonderful. It's just a great movie, funny all the way through. I mean, we've revealed all the plot points, all the story beats, but it doesn't matter. If you haven't seen this movie, go see it. It's just hilarious. It's just absolutely hilarious.
I think that's a good point. You know, it's, you know, we basically talked this movie scene by scene almost, but so much of it is in the performances.
Oh yeah.
And so much of it is in Albert Brooks' delivery, and even hearing about it is not the same thing as actually seeing it.
No.
It's definitely a movie worth watching for yourself.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful, wonderful movie. So I think that's going to do it for Lost in America. We've been talking for an hour, Max. The movie's only 90 minutes, so we've managed to cover like 2/3 of the movie.
Well, you know, I need to get back to my shift after Wiener Schnitzel, so.
We were eating the fries, and we hung them up to the light, and we could see there was a little bit of ice on the inside. We were eating them frozen. You're eating them frozen. Yeah, what do you want me to do? You know, so. I love that kid. Oh, God. Skippy, yeah? Out. He throws him out.
Yeah, because his name is Skip, but he says, call me Skippy.
Call me Skippy. He chooses to be called Skippy. Oh, it's fantastic. All the ancillary people that live in the Albert Brooks universe are golden. Like, every one of them. Again, the unemployment guy, the boss, the guy that fires him, Phil Shibano, who we never even see.
No.
He's great, but we know that he loves his boat, you know, and his life is coming true. He's only been there 2 years, and he's not creative, but he's going to become vice president. It's just...
Son of a bitch, Phil Shibano.
I love, he's like, he's, I love the whole, oh God, we're getting off track, but I love the whole thing where he's like, I don't want to hear about senior vice presidents. You don't care about that anymore. And Linda sees right through that. And she's like, who got the job? Hey, Phil Shibano. So Phil Shibano, the undeserving son of a bitch. God. Of this movie. Oh, my God. So, anyway, Max, thank you so much for coming on, man. I these movies are just, they mean so much to me. I love it. Well, maybe not looking for comedy in a Muslim world, but I love all of them so much. And especially these first four and five are just, to me, they're just perfect. And I'm so appreciative that I have somebody to talk to talk with somebody about them. And I love that you love them the way I do. And I look forward to talking about Real Life and Mother at some point. Yeah. We'll have to do those as well. Because those are classics. So thank you so much, Max. I always appreciate it. And I always just enjoy talking to you anyway. So this has been great.
Oh, well, thank you, Robin. And I really do. There's a purity to these Albert Brooks movies. And that's, you don't get to talk about these movies very often. They kind of get swept under the rug for some reason. And you know, if we can bring more people to Albert Brooks, that's great.
Yeah. This is a part of the Criterion collection, by the way. So Criterion clearly sees what a great movie this is. This is part of their deluxe collection, and it absolutely deserves it. He does not do audio commentaries, as far as I know. I mean, the only movies I've seen of his that are on DVD were just sort of like bare bones releases, because none of these were ever big hits. In fact, some of them were outright flops. So I guess there's no money in doing like deluxe. I would love to hear him do a commentary track.
Oh my God.
It would probably be astoundingly funny. But so we, you know, the movies just have to sort of exist on their own. But it is available on Blu-ray and as a Criterion collection. So where can people find you on our network, Max?
People can find me at Plasticast, which is the Plastic Man podcast that I have been doing. And you can also find me online at Twitter and Facebook at It's Plasticast, and also It's Plasticast at It's Plastic Man, and at Maxo Romero at both of those places.
Awesome. And of course, you can find back episodes of our show on the network site, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And we're talking movies all the time over on Twitter, which is at Film and Water Pod. So thanks everybody for listening. And until next week, stay out of Nevada.
This is Hans. Hold on, please.
Gee, I've been holding most of the morning.
Thank you, dear. Okay, thank you very much. Yeah, this is Hans.
Hans.
Yeah.
David Howard.
How are you, David?
Okay, listen.
Yeah.
I'm closing in on a decision.
Good.
I think the beige is the best interior.
Good interior now, huh?
And I think with the dark brown, that's the best combination.
That's the most beautiful combination on the lot.
All right, so tell me again. Uh-huh. Everything, tax, license, out the door, in my garage.
All right, well, I don't know where your garage is, but it's $44,420.
Wow.
All right.
It's a lot of money for a car, isn't it?
It's not a car, Mr. Howard. It's a Mercedes, and that's the
difference. No, I know it's a Mercedes, but it's just still a lot of money.
Well, maybe you shouldn't buy the car then. Get a Nova.
Okay.
Okay.
Now, there's no extras, right? That's it? That's everything? I don't imagine at that price I'd have to add.
Now, just leather. That's all you'd have to add. Nothing else.
Really?
Yeah.
It doesn't come with leather.
No, sir, it does not. That's why I told you you'd have to add it.
Well, what's in there?
Well, it's what they call Mercedes leather.
What would that be?
Well, it's a very thick vinyl. Beautiful seat. I would prefer that.
So let's call it that, then.
Fine. Beautiful, thick vinyl seat. But I have it.
Gee, isn't that something? Wouldn't you think there'd be leather in there?
I tell you what. If you buy the car, I'll put some shoes in it, okay?
Okay.
All right. So.
Well.
Uh-huh.
All right, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. I will see you when? Tomorrow night?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to think about it. Talk about it with my wife. It's a pretty big decision.
Let's set a day now. How about Friday morning?
I don't think I can commit to any day right now. Certainly
well,
not this week.
You're going to lose the car, you know. I have stars coming in here looking at the car.
Let me just call you back, all right? Hold on
car,
a second. I'm being buzzed. Hold on.
You know,
yeah.
Hi, it's time for your meeting.
Okay. I got Hans on the phone here. He's coming in for the kill. You want to help me out?